Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. As we continue in this extraordinary coronavirus crisis, we're sort of trying to figure out together how to get through this. This week, different perspectives on that. We talked with Congressman Adam Schiff for sort of the political reality of where things are at, this next fight in Congress. Carla Marinucci focuses more on the California angle of that. She's like the dean of California's politics. She's the political playbook person. She's talking every day with Governor Gavin Newsom. He's really sort of in the hot seat right now politically. And then we talk with Ryan Braun of the Milwaukee Brewers, former MVP of the National League. California Strong, he's one of the co-founders of that nonprofit, doing extraordinary work, raising millions of dollars for Californians. So I love all three of these people. They've all been on the show multiple times before, and we're excited to have them all back. So let's begin our conversation with our most frequent guest on the issue is Congressman Adam Schiff.
Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And by the way, we love your desk.
Thank you very much. I'm getting a lot of feedback on my desk these days.
All right. Let's talk about one of the big stories of the week, which is President Trump saying he wants the economy back open, but basically giving the governors the green light to do things the way they want to do them. Gavin Newsom says he likes the broad strokes of what the president's saying. What say you?
Well, you know, initially the president said that he alone was going to decide to reopen the country whenever he deemed it fit. But he's, I think, had to acknowledge the reality that, no, the governors are going to make these decisions on the basis of what's best for the people in their state. And you're already seeing governors band together with other governors in the region to try to work collectively because, of course, the virus doesn't stop at state borders. But they want to make sure, the governors want to make sure, and I think this makes all the sense in the world, that they are ready before they talk about reopening, that they have all the testing kits and the reagents and the swabs and the protective gear that they need to be able to identify where the virus is. Is it picking up steam? Is it losing steam? They want to make sure that the hospitals and clinics are prepared and not overwhelmed. And so they need certain prerequisites in place before they can take steps to partially reopen different sectors of the economy. I think that makes all the sense in the world. This push to prematurely open, really on a day yesterday when we had the greatest number of coronavirus deaths, over 4,000 in a single day, doesn't make sense until we're ready and could lead to more misery for people.
One of the most speaking of misery, you know, the economy is a miserable situation right now. One of the things that you guys did in Congress was you passed this $350 billion for small business loans, which really has allowed some people to keep their employees employed. Now that's out of money, and there's a debate about what happens next. What do you say to people that are really desperate right now and that see this bickering in Congress and say, what's going on there?
Well, I've been on the phone with small businesses, with small nonprofits. They want to see this program continue, and I think on a bipartisan basis, so do the members of Congress. But they've identified a lot of problems with it. People, particularly customers of large banks that apply, that are told, don't call us, we'll call you, have no idea whether their application is moving forward or not moving forward. And it looks like the big banks are giving their favored customers the best treatment and leaving others behind. We want to make sure those problems are addressed. We also know that our states, our cities, and our hospitals are in crisis right now, and they need resources too. So we're hoping that we can get bipartisan agreement to do all of that right now and then move to bigger relief items on the agenda down the road. But we need to get that additional help out to the hospitals and the cities and the states right now as well.
I mean, you're obviously not in session right now. You're in D.C. Most members are not in D.C. right now. Have you worked out a framework to potentially vote virtually or do virtual caucuses to actually make some of this legislation happen?
We have. In fact, we have had a conference call among the caucus on this yesterday. I need to be close by because I need to go into the Intelligence Committee from time to time, something I can't do at a distance to review classified information. But others should be able to vote more remotely and still participate. And we're exploring not remote voting yet, but rather being able to designate a proxy so that someone who is in ill health or very distant from the Capitol that doesn't want to or can't take the risk of getting on a plane right now because they're quarantined or for some other reason, they could say, I'm going to give my proxy to this member to vote for me. But it would be under very narrow circumstances. It would be not a broad delegation that says, for example, Adam Schiff could vote for me, but rather on this vote, this is how I want the vote conducted, and I'm going to authorize so-and-so to cast that vote for me. With the proper safeguards, that's what we're looking to put into place so that we can approve these packages quickly. Now, I should say this, Alex. There should be broad bipartisan agreement on adding more money to the small business program, making improvements in it, supporting our hospitals and clinics. And when we get to yes, I would hope that we can do that on unanimous consent so we don't even need to have this kind of proxy voting. But if necessary, if there's another Representative Massey, for example, that wants to hold up the works, we need to make provision for that.
One issue that may not have as much bipartisan agreement, but is certainly an interesting idea, is this Federal Paycheck Guarantee Act, which you are now supporting. Explain to folks how that would work and talk about if that has a chance of passing.
I've thought really for months now that the best approach to this economic problem that we have, this economic crisis, is not a quilt of different programs, a $500 billion fund for these industries and a different fund for smaller businesses and overwhelming our unemployment compensation system, but rather have the federal government, as the British government and the Swedish and Norwegian and other governments are doing, have the federal government guarantee a large percent of payroll, 80 or 90 or even 100% of payroll, until we get through this. So that workers don't get laid off, they don't have to go on unemployment. When the economy comes back, they don't have to start looking all over again for a job. Businesses don't have to close, and it's done fairly. Banks aren't giving preference to favored, lucrative customers. The president's not giving preference to his pals or punishing his enemies in industry, but rather the payroll of each and every large and small business would be covered while we go through this to a certain percentage. To me, that's simpler, more equitable, and it can be done through the IRS more quickly than through the commercial banks and the SBA.
So how expensive is that, and are you seeing any Republican support for it?
There are different estimates depending on how generous you want to go in terms of what percentage of payroll. And there are a couple different proposals, one by my Democratic colleague, Pramila Jayapal, that I'm co-sponsoring, that would guarantee up to 100%. And another in the Senate by Republican Josh Harley, very conservative, that would guarantee 80%. And I think somewhere in that range is appropriate. But depending on what range you use, the costs differ. It might be $150 billion a month. But frankly, the way we're going through the funds for the small business program, the amount we've allocated for large industry, we're going to go through that amount anyway, and it would be better, I think, to do it in a more equitable way, in a way that avoids people and small businesses and large laying off large numbers of people.
I mean, that sounds good to a lot of folks, I'm sure, that are listening. Is there a real chance that this could pass?
There is a real chance. It's going to require, I think, a lot of groundswell of support for it. There is some question about whether the Republicans in Congress are going to go along with any new package after we provide an additional infusion to small businesses and we hope to states and cities and hospitals. But I think the reality is going to be that the crisis is going to continue for some time. There is going to be a call in the Congress to do more. And rather than do it in piecemeal fashion, I think we ought to embrace the broader vision and the simpler and more equitable vision that's laid out in these proposals.
This is hurting so many different businesses, including journalism. This week, we found out that the Glendale News Press, Burbank Leader, other small papers, I know in your district, are not going to continue anymore. We're seeing problems up and down the state for journalism at this moment. You think Congress might be able to get involved in this? How?
Well, it's a terrible tragedy, and we saw in L.A. What so many communities around the country are seeing an announcement last night that the Glendale News Press, the Burbank Leader, and the Valley Sun, all L.A. Times community papers, are now closing their doors. These papers have been around in one form or another for decades, some for almost 100 years, and to see this kind of really important local journalism and interconnective tissue between our communities disappearing is deeply tragic. Now, some of these are small businesses. They're not owned by large papers, and they actually can participate in that SBA program that already exists. But and this underscores one of the problems we've identified with the SBA program. Many of these small papers and other small organizations and nonprofits aren't getting the loans. And I think it's because they're not the bank's best customers. They're not the most lucrative customers. But that's not really what Congress had in mind, to let banks pick winners and losers among their customers. But nonetheless, this is a real tragedy. And the result will be local matters won't get the same coverage. Local corruption won't get exposed. But also, you know, that connectivity between people in a community, great, you know, achievements in local sports and local philanthropy won't get reported. And that really is quite a shame, and we ought to explore what can be done about it.
On another front in terms of the news this week, you officially endorsed Joe Biden. Surprising you didn't endorse President Trump. I know there was some suspense on who was going to be the one that you would endorse in that showdown. But Joe Biden is an old school political guy who loves shaking hands, who loves looking people in the eye, who likes human interaction in a way that few people do. And yet he's stuck at his place in Delaware, not able to interact with people right now. What's your advice to Joe Biden for sort of navigating this new world in terms of winning a campaign in such uncharted waters?
Well, you know, it's a real challenge, I think, for elected officials at every level who can't get out and press the flesh and can't do big campaign events, can't even do small campaign events right now. And, you know, a lot of the campaigning is done virtually. It's done through video conferences. And that's what Joe Biden is doing. It's what he's going to have to continue to do. You know, likewise, the president can't go to those rallies that he loves so much and that are such a boost, I think, to his ego to hear those adoring crowds gather for him. But he's been able to use the White House as his campaign podium in a way that's difficult for candidates to emulate. But I guess my advice to Joe Biden and to other candidates running for office is use the tools that you have. We're all basically in the same position these days. And I think if your message is compelling, then it's compelling in a virtual format just as it would be compelling in person. And we're all going to have to retool given the realities of social distancing.
I think your desk is more compelling than his bookcase. Let's make that better. Let's talk for a moment. We always like to have a little fun on this show. Quarantine life, what it's like for you. And we spoke recently. You said you were not doing The Tiger King. You were doing old movies. Have you changed on that? And what are you watching these days?
Well, I just watched Diner, which was fantastic. I hadn't seen it in years. And so I'm continuing with the old movies. I'm also really jumping from show to show to see, you know, which one will capture my attention. And I'm open to recommendations of your audience. But one thing I will tell you is my daughter gave me a haircut. You can be the judge of how she did. But if people look at my Instagram page, they'll see the video that she put together of it, which I thought was quite clever. But then she is my kid, and I think everything she does is very clever.
Very nicely done. Carla, welcome back to The Issue Is.
So good to be here, Alex. Thanks for having me.
All right, so Governor Newsom doing these briefings every day at noon, big ratings up and down the state. How do you think he's doing?
I mean, this has been amazing. You know, Governor Newsom spent the first year in office making himself a thorn in the side of President Trump, and now, you know, this is how crazy it is. He's a breakout star in the president's reelection ad campaign. And that just that came out this week. And that just shows how things have changed. I mean, Newsom is a star in national politics. He's on Ellen DeGeneres today. He's become a hot item on The View. His poll numbers are through the roof. He's number one among all of the governors in terms of job approval rating right now. 83%, that's up more than half, 50% up since before the COVID pandemic. And in part because, look, he and Donald Trump are now BFFs. I mean, they are getting along. Trump is praising him every day. And that has worked in Newsom's favor. He has gotten what he's needed for California. Californians like that. Even his political foes are saying, you know, he's shown discipline, he's shown focus, and he's been able to do things like create a consortium with Western states, put together a $1 billion deal on masks. At this point, Gavin Newsom is riding high. We'll see how long that lasts. But the fact is, he's in a very sweet spot right now for a governor.
It turns out that being nice to Donald Trump may be the best thing he ever did, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually catapulted him to the national stage in a way that he wasn't before. As I said, I mean, he's now a hot item on all these national shows. And many more people on the eastern seaboard and in southern states know who Gavin Newsom is when they didn't before. And certainly when you're looking ahead at his political career in the future, that can't be a bad thing.
And we got to give credit also. It's great to see that the death toll in California proportionally
yes.
is so much lower than we are seeing in other states. So that, of course, is the most important part of all of this.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Newsom made a big splash. He went on Rachel Maddow, announced this massive purchase of masks from this Chinese company. But sometimes in politics, the devil is in the details. We had this virtual legislature hearing this week, which was really weird, with a few people wearing masks, other people trying to connect in virtually. It started an hour late because they couldn't get the technology to work. And then like the system crashed because there was so much demand. But what they're looking at, the bottom line of that is they're thinking, does this deal really make sense that the governor's getting us in?
Yeah, I mean, this is where the legislators are wanting to weigh in now. They're doing these virtual town halls at home, but now we're getting down to actually doing business again. And they did have a lot of questions. What are the details? And Newsom's office basically says, well, right now, it's really fragile. We've got to get this thing done. It's a question, you know, this is a real sort of competition here between legislators wanting to do their job and doing oversight, and Newsom's people saying, hey, let's take care of business first. Let's get these masks out. Let's save lives. The clash is going to be coming. We're going to see more of Newsom getting criticism from the legislature. I think right now he's kind of the golden boy because he's managed to handle everything at once and juggle all these balls with Trump. But now comes, you know, the details, as you said, on that and many other deals that he's making. And I think he's going to take a lot more questions, get a lot tougher questions from the press at those Newsom at noon briefings as well.
Yet still, he's getting a lot of positive attention. Your pal, my pal, Jessica Levinson of Loyola Law School, writing an article suggesting that maybe Gavin Newsom should replace Joe Biden on the ticket.
I saw that.
Probably not going to happen, but that's obviously a good sign for Gavin Newsom. People are even bringing that up.
Absolutely. I mean, look, people have always looked at him with regard to being a future White House potential, and now more so whether he would replace Joe Biden, we'll see on that. But the fact is, when it comes to Joe Biden, he's still not there yet. I think that's the interesting thing.
Joe Biden was on CNN this week, and the interview wasn't exactly inspiring. Let's take a listen.
Kinds of things that have to be done. You know, there's a during World War II, you know, where Roosevelt came up with a thing was totally different than the World War II. He had the War Production Board.
Huh? What is that? I mean, Joe Biden is stuck in this situation where he's stuck at home. The president gets to go out on TV every day. These governors get to go out on TV and actually do something. And that's the response?
Yeah, I know. I mean, look, we've all had moments like that. Let me just say that. But the fact is that for Joe Biden, that kind of moment ends up being used by Donald Trump Jr., as it was this morning on Twitter. He basically said, hey, those debates are going to be great. Joe Biden is, as we know, is very articulate, is very impassioned, and has moments like this on Zoom that are going to be used against him. And you're absolutely right, Alex. I mean, the fact that he's in the bunker there delivering these messages, that puts him at a disadvantage to Donald Trump, who's out there every day at the White House briefing. Trump knows that. He's using those briefings sometimes to the ridiculous levels. They go on for 2 hours. Even conservative groups are criticizing him for that. But Joe Biden needs to be more focused. And people say maybe put together a kitchen cabinet and have discussions on Zoom, much like we're doing right now, to get his message across. That might be more effective.
And he could actually have it from his kitchen.
Yeah, exactly.
The advantage of doing
as that. As I am right now.
Interesting that Barack Obama endorsed him within the last week. Bernie Sanders has now endorsed him. Elizabeth Warren has endorsed him. I mean, the Democratic Party is very unified, and yet there's almost no discussion of any of those endorsements, given what everything else that's happening right now.
I know. I mean, look, this critical situation is bigfooting everything, as it should, when you talk about the kinds of mortality rates and infection rates that we're talking about, and it will change. And I think a lot of people wondered why Barack Obama took so long to endorse Biden. I think that was one of the reasons. There's too much national attention and too much import on what's going on to solve this crisis. But now you're going to see Democrats, I think, talk about it more. There's certainly more discussion about Joe Biden and who he's going to pick as the vice presidential candidate. We had Kamala Harris yesterday saying she would be honored to have that job. And you're getting questions to people like Gavin Newsom, like, hey, when are you going to endorse him? And Newsom is saying, I'm a little busy right now. I'll get to that. And I think the Democrats will probably give it a pass for now. But definitely all of those folks that were on the debate stage with Joe Biden, all of those Democratic candidates are now behind him and with him. And that is a very big deal for the Democrats.
And all of them want to be his VP. Right. Even if they don't tell you that, they all want to be his VP.
Exactly, right.
All right. Carla, it is always great to talk with you. Thank you for all the great questions during those briefings. Ryan Braun, the former MVP of the National League, star outfielder with the Milwaukee Brewer. He is also the co-founder of California Strong, which has raised more than $3 million for Californians in need. Ryan Braun, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
So we'll talk about the important charity work in a moment, but let's begin by talking about baseball. Do you think that you're going to be playing baseball in front of a crowd of people this season?
I'm optimistic that there will be some semblance of a baseball season. I think it will, in all likelihood, look drastically different than any baseball season we've played before or anybody else has had an opportunity to watch before. I'm trying to stay as positive and optimistic as possible. Obviously, the situation is so fluid. There's constantly new news and information coming out on a daily basis. So I do hope that we play baseball. I don't think it's too likely that we play baseball in front of fans, at least anytime in the near future.
So you talk to these guys all the time. What do you think it's going to look like? What does baseball without fans even look like?
You know, it's going to be different. It's going to be drastically different. I think this is something that we're all trying to figure out. Obviously, life in general is going to be different for all of us when we come out on the other side of this pandemic. For us as athletes, we don't know what to expect. We've kind of tried to come up with a lot of different possibilities and options and be as prepared as possible in the event that we get to a place where the health and safety has been taken care of to the extent that we're able to play. But we really don't know what to expect. I think the only thing we do know is it's going to be drastically different than anything we've seen before.
We've heard the thought that there might be a baseball season where all the teams are all in Arizona playing with no fans. What do you make of that possibility?
I think, unfortunately, it might be our only option at this point. I think we're either looking at all teams in Arizona or half the teams in Arizona, the other half the teams in Florida where they have their spring training facilities. You eliminate a lot of variables that way. I think that having all 30 teams in 30 separate cities is something that's extremely unlikely because of the travel challenges that come with that, staying in different hotels, different bus drivers and different clubhouses and clubhouse personnel and all the variables that come into play if we're in 30 different cities. So obviously that's not something that any of us had anticipated. It's not something that we would choose to do. But if the option is either no sports whatsoever or we can play our sport in a drastically different setting, I think that we all are remaining hopeful and optimistic that at some point we're able to play, even if it's drastically different than what we've experienced in the past.
I mean, you've been playing in front of big crowds since you were a high school star here in Southern California, two or three years ago. You've been playing in front of crowds for like 20 years, Ryan. What would that be like playing baseball for you in front of no crowd?
It'd be different, something none of us have ever experienced. But there are so many larger issues at play. And I think everybody's lives have been drastically altered in ways none of us could have ever imagined. So, you know, we hope that baseball is a part of the solution. We hope that baseball is eventually a major milestone when it comes to all of us returning to some semblance of normalcy. But playing in front of fans will be drastically different. I think the atmosphere and the environment that the fans create is so unique. It's something that we're all incredibly appreciative of and grateful for. And it's not something that any of us as baseball players would choose to experience. But again, if the option is either no baseball or baseball without fans, we hope that we're able to play some type of baseball, even if it's without anybody in the ballpark.
You know, when you think about sports, it's such an important part of the economy as well, not only for the athletes on the field, but you think about all the people, all the concession workers. I know you and your teammate and California Strong co-founder Christian Yelich have both given, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to help pay for the concession workers at Miller Park, where you play in Wisconsin. Think about that, all the people that are being impacted in all these different ways by what's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, it's devastating. You know, it's heartbreaking to think of how many humans have been so adversely impacted by everything that they've experienced throughout the course of this pandemic. Obviously, there are so many people that contribute to us being able to play baseball. It's all the people that work in the ballparks, work in the stadiums, work in the front office, all the people that handle all of our travel accommodations. There's countless people that have been impacted, and it's heartbreaking to think about what they're going through. So for us to be able to do our small part and help those people, and as much as anything, for them to know that we care about them, that we're going to be here to help them now and hopefully help them into the future, is something that is incredibly meaningful to us. But again, as you said, there's so many people that help allow us to be able to do our jobs, whose lives have been forever impacted by this situation.
Yeah, I mean, you've been giving in so many different ways. Let's talk about California Strong. This was co-founded by you and a group of other athletes back in 2018 following the Woolsey fire. Your big fundraiser, you look at the group there that co-founded it there, Mike Moustakas and Mike Atanasio, who's one of the Brewers' co-founders, and Christian Yelich, also Jared Goff from the Rams, also one of the co-founders. You got this big celebrity softball game that is your main fundraiser with really big stars in it. And the last guy on the bench last year, I can't believe you recruited me to play. I got a double, ran as fast as I possibly could without embarrassing myself. AKA MVP, right? And then there was a moment, I have to admit, Ryan, during that game where Cody Bellinger, of course, the Dodgers MVP, hit a line drive right towards my head, and I had an Anchorman moment where I'm like, not the face, and ran the other direction in order not to have it hit me.
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. I think that you're clearly athletic. I think that once an athlete, always an athlete. You performed well. We enjoyed having you out there. But as you alluded to, the support we've gotten from other athletes, from actors, actresses, musicians, prominent people in the business world has been overwhelming. It's something none of us could have expected. And it's allowed us to have a far greater impact than we could have ever dreamed of having over a relatively short period of time. And it allows us to help people in a time of need like this. I mean, this is literally an unprecedented time of need where almost every single human needs help. And the goal of California Strong is to be able to have the widespread impact and be able to help as many of these people as possible. And playing a celebrity softball game is something that allows us to generate funds to give back to these people who are in a time of need.
I mean, because one of your main points, and we're now looking at me with my double, one of your main points that you talked about when you were on the show last time, which was essentially you wanted to create a rainy day fund with California Strong because you knew that there would be future instances where people would need help and you'd want to be able to have a way to immediately get them help. And you've already done that in this situation, given out more than $120,000 already in direct financial aid to Californians who are being impacted by coronavirus, $130,000 to researchers at UCLA, UCSF, Cedars-Sinai, plus providing over 100,000 meals to Feeding America, which is a great organization that's doing such important work. I mean, when what does it feel like to you to be able to do that in this moment?
You know, we're proud. We're proud of being able to give back. We're incredibly grateful for the overwhelming amount of support we've received from the community. As I mentioned, to everybody else that's contributed to our campaign to this point. But more than anything, I think in a moment like this, there are so many people that are doing so much good. There are so many people that are trying to help. And I think that it sends a message of unity. It sends a message of all of us being there to help each other through this. This is a situation that we're all in together. Our best chance to come out on the other side in as good a place as possible is for all of us to be in this together, to help each other through it. And our goal, again, is to have as widespread an impact as possible, be able to help as many people as possible. So we've tried to do that through Feeding America, which is doing incredible things, through UCLA Health, UCSF Health, Cedars-Sinai, and through giving financial aid directly to people who have been impacted. So we're doing our small part, and we're incredibly grateful for everyone else who's contributing as well in their own ways.
And if you can help them, I know a lot of people have a need right now, but there's a lot of people who may have a little bit of extra money. CaliforniaStrong.org is where you can go to donate money to them to help make this even more possible. And you're not only doing that, you're also back home in Wisconsin, or where the Brewers play in Wisconsin. You're at home now. You're partnering with the Third Street Market, providing meals to healthcare workers. We have some images of that, and it really is remarkable when you see the healthcare workers and sort of under their masks, you can sort of tell the smiles on their faces as you're a part of helping to feed them.
Yeah, it's incredibly impactful. I mean, it's emotional to see those images. Again, the goal is just to be able to help as many of these people as possible, to let them know that we're thinking about them. All of our healthcare workers and first responders are heroic in their efforts, I think. You know, the selflessness they've shown, I think the disregard for their own safety and health is something that none of us could ever thank them enough for. So this is just us trying to let them know that we see what they're doing. We're incredibly grateful for the sacrifices that they're making. And hopefully, you know, I think everybody else does recognize the heroic effort that we're seeing from our healthcare workers and first responders throughout the course of this pandemic.
Obviously, you've been playing baseball for a long time, but now you've been doing this charity work for several years, too. What have you learned about yourself, and what have you learned about other people through the experience of doing this charity work?
You know, there's no more meaningful thing you can do on this planet than positively impact other people's lives. And I think for all of us as athletes, we've tried to use the position that we're in to help other people. There's no greater feeling for us personally, and then to hear their stories and to see the impact we've been able to make on people's lives is something that is incredibly impactful. I think it's just motivated and inspired us to try to do more, to help as many people as possible. We recognize from the beginning that inevitably there are things that happen across the world, and specifically in our state, in which people are going to need help. And that was kind of the goal from the beginning of this campaign that we started, was to be able to help these people to be in a position to give back, to use our platform for positive change. And I think that that's something that we've tried to do to this point, and that we're inspired to continue to do moving forward.
Meanwhile, you're also a father of two of the cutest kids ever. I mean, I feel like you guys, the pictures of you guys is like what we should see in the frames that you would buy at a store or something.
And my wife deserves
you're now
all credit
home
for any cute pictures.
For the first time in your sort of career, you're now home with the kids. What's quarantine life like? How are you adjusting personally?
It's different. You know, again, I think for all of us, we're trying to figure out our new normal as much as anything as parents, just trying to keep the kids entertained, trying to keep some semblance of routine for them. My kids are 3 and 5, and we actually have another child that's due in about a month. So we have our hands full, but at the same time, we are, you know, enjoying the extra family time, really grateful from my perspective for the extra time that I'm getting to spend with them, trying to make the best of it, trying to stay as positive as we can. But again, trying to keep them entertained all day is challenging at times, so I think all parents of young children could attest.
Are you nervous at all about having a baby during all this?
Yes, very. You know, we anticipated there being baseball at this time, so we would been in Milwaukee to have the child there. So that presented its own set of unique circumstances for us. And then obviously we don't know what hospitals will look like a month from now. So it's scary, I think, that anybody who's going through a similar situation would probably have a similar answer. It's not something any of us have ever experienced before. We're trying to gather as much information as possible, make educated decisions, but obviously at some point in about a month, we'll be in a hospital and we just have to hope that we're put in the best position possible, but it is it's scary.
Well, we're wishing you the best, a preemptive mazel tov to you and your family.
Thank you.
Our thanks this week to Congressman Adam Schiff, to Carla Marinucci, and to Ryan Braun. And thank you for listening. Thank you for all that you're doing to try to stay home and stay safe. And a biggest thank you, of course, to our first responders who are doing such important work to save lives during this unprecedented crisis. I'm Alex Michelson. Follow me on social media. Let me know what you think about the show. We're interested in trying to answer any questions you may have about coronavirus, too, and trying to get you some answers. Have an interesting opportunity to talk to leaders right now and trying to get that information to you. Again, stay safe, and we'll see you next time.